from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, Alfredo Corchado, the Mexico bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News, has been reporting on Mexico's drug war since 1994. The cartels have murdered journalists, and in 2007, Alfredo Corchado was told he was their next target. He'll join us to talk about his new book, Midnight in Mexico, and to share his thoughts on immigration reform and Mexico's future. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this hour of the Forum program. Alfredo Corchado did not want to cover the drug cartels when he first went off to Mexico as a journalist, but cover them he did, and he has been doing that since 1994. He's also appeared with us a number of times on Forum to discuss the drug wars and violence in Mexico, as well as immigration issues and Mexican politics. And he recently published a book about all of that, as well as his personal story and his love, despair, and hope for his native country, which he left at a young age with his family, after which he became an American citizen. The book Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness, focuses on the blood-dimmed tide of the drug wars and Alfredo Corchado's own fears that he had been targeted for assassination by one of the major drug cartels. The Mexico bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News, Alfredo Corchado, is an award-winning journalist and a former Needman, Woodrow Wilson, and Rockefeller Fellow. He joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. Good to have you here in the flesh.
Well, Michael, it's indeed a pleasure, and it's great to be back in this region, and I still feel like it's home. You know?
Well, bienvenidos, and welcome to the program. And I should say, just in terms of, you call yourself a son of Mexico, which indeed you are, and father was a bracero. You and your brothers picked, as you say in the book, every imaginable crop. And the fact of the matter is this book is, as an American diplomat said, kind of a mole. I mean, it's about the drug cartels, but it's really also about the history of Mexico, your personal history. It's a lot to pack into a single book.
It is. And when he said that, he said, "You're making mole." I said, "I have no idea how to make mole, but I'm going to pour every ounce of my soul into it." And I hope that that's what the reader finds.
Well, and you didn't want to cover the cartels. In fact, I think, would you want to be a hairdresser, Fredo? You want to follow Warren Beatty's footsteps? I don't want to embarrass you.
I was a huge fan of shampoo, and I thought I could be the next Warren Beatty, the Mexican-American version of Warren Beatty, if you will.
So instead, low salary, high risk job and covering the cartels from about 94 on, even in a time when 14 journalists, all Mexican, between 2006 and 2012 in the Calderon era were killed.
Mexico today, I think, is one of the most dangerous places to do journalism. I still feel like I'm lucky, I'm privileged that even though I'm Mexican born in Durango, I have a U.S. passport, and that gives me protection that my colleagues in Mexico lack.
Well, on the other hand, there are people who said to you, but you look Mexican and you can be taken for Mexican. Maybe you don't have that immunity.
That's right. Very good source of mine, a U.S. Investigator, looked at me once and I said, "Hey, what's the likelihood that I could be a target?" And he says, "Well, good news and bad news. Good news is cartels don't want to mess with Americans. It brings too much attention to their billion-dollar business. Bad news, bro, you don't look American."
Well, and when you got this threat, I mean, it provides a lot of the narrative power to your book. It was very serious because you knew, of course, that people had been killed, their families had been killed, anybody sometimes even related to them. By the cartels were and have been just extraordinarily willing to do terrible carnage.
This was July of 2007. Had just won a big award and had been doing a lot of radio interviews. And friends and colleagues were flying in. We were going to have a big celebration. This same U.S. Investigator calls and says, "Hey, we just got word. There are three names on a hit list. I think it's you. I would get out." And I had received other threats, but this one obviously took me by—I was shocked because it was coming from a very reliable source, someone who I trusted. And my initial instinct was, okay, like previous times, I'll call my editor and I'm out of here, which is a privilege that I have that my Mexican colleagues don't have. But I thought, if these guys are really serious and they can't get after me, will they go after my girlfriend and colleague, or will they go after family members? I mean, I have family on both sides of the border. Some people have said, you know, I was reckless in deciding to stay, but I did stay for a while, and I did try to investigate it, try to reach out to sources, informants, et cetera, on both sides of the border.
You have more informants than anybody I know of, I mean, just from reading your book. But also, you knew where the threat was coming from. It was coming from the Zeta cartel.
That's what the U.S. investigator, and that's really why I took it so seriously, because these guys had really changed the whole dynamic of organized crime in Mexico. I mean, ruthless, very power-hungry, controlling, and we had been doing some stories on their reach into the United States. The story we had just done days before the threat was about a peace pact between the government and the cartels. And I think that's really, you know, I think cartels like when you do stories about them. I mean, glorifies them in one way or another. But when you really get into the whole money aspect,
and you can affect their pocketbook.
Exactly. The corruption between government and cartels, that's when they really get serious.
You can't even tell the difference in many instances, can you?
Oftentimes, I mean, I found myself like, who are the bad guys? Who are the good guys? And I think for someone, you know, when I started doing this, I had told my parents, I want to be a journalist. I want to go back to Mexico. I want to go back to my native land. And I promised them I would not cover cartels. So when I started really, after journalism went through a bad spell and our bureau went down from 13 people to one person, I had no choice but to cover cartels. I think I was a little naive, if you will, and maybe a little idealistic that democracy would take care of things. So when I started covering this, I wasn't really taking the precautions that maybe I should have taken. I mean, I cover the cartels very much like any Mexican journalist or any journalist would, you know, follow the money. Follow the corruption without measuring the consequences. In retrospect, I often think, what the heck was I doing?
But you knew, for example, that the Zeta cartel was a paramilitary group. It had ties to the government.
Right. And 35 members were at that point had now formed a personal, you know, they were personal bodyguards for Ociel Cárdenas Guillén, who at the time was the leader of the GAF cartel. And this was early. This was 2004 or so. It hadn't become personal. I mean, it was just a cartel. But I think when we started writing stories about the reach into Dallas, it became a lot more, you know, why is the Dallas Morning News doing so much? And I think the cartels, or the, in this case, the Zetas cartels, were also questioning, where is the information coming from?
When you write about your native land, and there's obviously a great deal of love that you feel for Mexico that comes across in your book, and you talk about hope and fear and, you know, the two kind of vacillating and so forth. But at one point early on, you say, and talking about this particular era, evil was running wild in Mexico.
My mother always felt that when we left Mexico, that was one reason why she wanted to leave. She felt that there was something wrong in Mexico. We didn't come from the right bloodline. We didn't have the same privileges as the rich. And she felt like, you know, there were no opportunities for us. We had had a family tragedy, and she felt there was some kind of a mal, if you will, an evil in Mexico, and that the only way to get away from that was to leave for the United States. I came here kicking and screaming, but in fact, right before we left Mexico. We went from Durango, where I was born, to Ciudad Juarez to get our paperwork together. And right before we crossed the border, I mean, it was a year after, right before we crossed the border, we went to a curandera, and she performed a cleansing. And it was her way, my mother's way of saying, we have taken the evil out, and now you can start anew in the United States, pure and free.
In fact, this is, you write about the limpia, the cleaning ritual that comes with the rains, but also the fact that your own umbilical cord is buried in Mexican soil, which is a ritual that was done, and you felt that connection, almost like an umbilicus connection to your native land, even though your mother and father came here and worked hard and had a restaurant and became somewhat successful by, I suppose, middle-class standards. Yeah,
I think that, you know, Michael, that was really the most fascinating part of reporting was going back home, going back to Durango, and talking to all my relatives, and then actually seeing where you were born. I mean, there are literally church bells shadowing, you know, the little room where I came, you know, as an infant. Then we walked around, and they said, you know, there is the umbilical cord that belongs to your father, your grandfather, your tios, your aunts, etc. That just, I mean, I think was the most moving part for me to go back and get away from the silence of being a reporter and try to actually share my whole personal story with readers.
The book, again, is Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. Alfredo Corchado with us in studio, and we'll give you an opportunity to speak with him. I know many of you of Mexican heritage and Mexican descent may want to weigh in here, but also questions about the cartels from someone who has really managed to glean. He may have come to it naively, but how did you get all these informants? I mean, you're a good guy and everything, and a dogged journalist, but I mean, you had people on both sides of the border, but also people on both sides of the law.
Well, that's a secret. But, we can get into it.
Well, I mean, just in terms of, in a broad way, the method of developing a technique of establishing this retinue, really.
Sure. I mean, there's one informant in the book that I write about. Her nickname is La Paisana. And unbeknownst to me, back when we had a restaurant on South El Paso Street, just two blocks from the International Bridge, a place called Freddy's Cafe, she was one of the regulars. And she would come in. I mean, you know, these were an eclectic group, if you will. We had politicians. We had smugglers.
She was a smuggler.
She was a smuggler, yeah. And she was from Durango, and that's why the name Paisana. But one day she comes in, and she had some bottles. I was serving her menudo or enchiladas or something, and suddenly I tipped over a bottle, and instead of wine, there was little packages. And so years later, when I was introduced by a U.S. Drug enforcement agent, we started talking, and some of she mentioned that she had once smuggled cocaine through Malbec bottles of Malbec wine. And I said, wait a minute. And so we renewed our friendship, this time not as a waiter and customer, but as a reporter and someone working for the U.S. government.
Well, she comes alive as a very, put it mildly, fascinating character. I'm looking at a section in your book where you're under threat and you're, you know, in a state of high anxiety. And she says, Alfredo, there's not much difference between the cartels and the government. They're both the same blanks. You understand? You're a fly to them. No more, no less. They'll swat you in a second without a blink.
I was...
this is someone who knew that whole world very well, obviously.
Right, and someone who still knows that world very well. And I was lucky in that sense that I could kind of reach out to people like Paisana and try to measure just how serious this threat was. And that was one of the first things she asked me. She goes, you know, you didn't write that story about the pack, did you? I go, yes, that was me. And she says, oh, my God, you know, you need to stay low. I mean, keep a low profile.
There is a woman who was just arrested, you're probably aware of, in Kansas, who was a major cartel figure and who was running things. And I saw Oliver Stone's not terribly great movie called Savages, where Selma Hayek plays this. Are women moving into this cartel world?
I think women have always been part of the
I mean, the
cartel
higher
world.
Tiers, though, in fact?
I think you're seeing that more and more.
Yeah.
I mean, we've as reporters, we've seen that. I mean, I think that's one of the interesting trends, not just in the hierarchy of cartels, but also we've seen a lot more women, for example, in some of the hard-hit states that have banded together to try to take on the cartels. That's one of the stories that Paisana keeps telling me. You know, you have to do women who want to take revenge because they lost their sons, they lost their loved ones, and they're banding and not just taking on cartels, but also getting into the cartel business, the drug business.
Well, she gave you advice, you know, right out of Lear, as boys to wanton gods, so as flies to wanton boys, so are we to the gods. And these are kind of the gods of the cartels that just don't care and sweat flies without any kind of conscience at all, the ruthlessness that you spoke of earlier. But for many years, of course, 71 years to be exact, the PRI was in charge, and then there was a shift, and it became very bloody. Now we're back to the PRI, and I think at one point you say, when you actually met and interviewed Peña Nieto, and you said, it's sad for Mexico again. You think things are just going backwards?
You know, it was... that was one of the interesting things about doing this book is showing your emotions, right, and expressing and exposing your pain.
You can't do that as a journalist.
No, you don't. In July of 2012, going to the pre-office to see the new president-elect, was one of my saddest afternoons in Mexico, because I had seen what felt like a people's revolution along the U.S.-Mexico border, people trying to reclaim their homeland, and suddenly the priest back. I met him, and I think the first question he asked me was, are you Mexican or are you American? And I gave my story, and I said, I'm from Durango. I have family in California. And he says, well, how did they vote? Did they vote for me? And I responded, I said, well, if they did, they did it more for your wife than for you. His wife is
a famous soap opera star.
Exactly. Yeah. And he just kind of laughed. But he's very, very, very smooth. And I think he's been very effective in trying to downplay expectations about bringing down the violence, you know, so quickly in his administration.
Well, he's apparently taken a softer view, I mean, to put it bluntly, hasn't he, in terms of going after the drug merchants?
His focus has been, and he said it repeatedly, is to try to bring down the violence. And he's focused a lot more on the economy, the economic miracle of Mexico, as he puts it, or also trying to fight poverty. The problem is that I don't think much has changed in terms of violence, in terms of numbers. You know, maybe they're measuring different categories. You know, but we're still seeing violence in many regions of Mexico. If anything, places like Ciudad Juarez at one point were much more dangerous, much more violent.
We had you on, in fact, talking about
right,
it.
Yeah. Right, right. That I think situation there has calmed down, but other regions have exploded. But I think voters. Mexicans are like, okay, let's give him some time. Let's see if things really do improve. But it's difficult as a journalist and it's difficult as Mexicans to try to turn the page and say, you know what, 100,000 people, nothing really happened here. Let's just move on. I often get a sense in Mexico that it'll be very difficult to have peace without justice. And especially when you have a conviction rate of less than 5%, some people say less than 2%. I think people will probably give Peña Nieto some time, but I don't think this is over.
The economy's doing better, though.
Economy's doing
a lot
better.
And in fact, I think you went on record once, Shannon O'Neill, who was, I think, on a program with you from the Council of Foreign Relations, interviewed you, and you said, I think we're not going to have this. The immigration's going to cease.
I have said, and I, you know, immigration is a big issue in the United States, but I often tell people, I think at some point you're going to miss Mexicans. The birth rate has gone down from 7 to 2. Sometimes as a reporter, yes, you cover violent regions, but there are other places that are prosperous. And as a reporter, you feel like, you know, this is just really two Mexicos. One of the most interesting reactions I get from in the Dallas, North Texas area, we have the one labor market, which is El Bajío, the central part of Mexico and North Texas. But over and over, I keep hearing people, I say, well, do you plan to go to the United States? Do you plan to go to Texas, North Texas? And people say, well, maybe, but, you know, more out of curiosity than necessity. And that's something that in covering Mexico over 20 years, it's something
that's a
I
big
never
switch.
Heard. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You also, at one point in the book, say it's common. I mean, here you were under threat, but you said Mexicans threaten constantly. It's almost like you're suggesting something in the culture has to do with threatening.
That's in the book with Samuel Lopez, who's a good friend of mine and has been with me on this journey for a big part of the journey. He's kind of sort of my bodyguard, if you will, and the driver. But when I told him about the threats, he said, look, that's just part of Mexico. We don't have rule of law, so the best thing we do is we pick up the phone and we call someone and we just threaten them, and it works. And so he said, look, just relax. This is probably part of the strategy to try to quiet you down.
And you talk about your driver. There's a good deal of there's a portrait, for example, of a maid who worked for you for years who was very loyal to you. You thought
right. And I think that was really when, as immigrants, you know, we were so nostalgic for the motherland, and we romanticized it. And when I went back to Mexico, I was so excited. And I thought, and I would tell, whether it was a maid or the gardener, I would tell him stories about having grown up in California and having worked for Cesar Chavez And, you know, my mother was very much influenced by the Robert F. Kennedy quote, the some people see the way things are and ask why other people think things that never were and ask why not. And I would repeat that to them, like, I'm one of you. Suddenly all my cans, you know, jalapeno cans were missing and other stuff was missing. And I finally confronted her and she says, oh, I thought they were going to expire, so I took them. Plus, I want to help the Chiapas, the movement, help the poor. And I kept looking at her and I said, Señora Carmen, you don't have to steal. Just tell me. And it's like she couldn't understand or imagine how a Mexican wearing a tie could be like her. And that told me so much about Mexico. And it really made me understand and appreciate the United States, because I thought, you know, if...
Well, we have a class system here, too.
Right. Well, there's a class system, but I always feel like, you know, especially as an immigrant, migrant worker, I always feel like I always stand a chance here. And I think in Mexico, I thought it just felt stuck. We eventually parted ways, but that told me so much about the Mexico that we left behind.
Fredo Corchado is our guest. His new book is Midnight in Mexico, and he was Mexico bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News, who's been reporting on Mexico's drug war since 1994. And I'd like to hear from you. If you'd like to join this conversation, we certainly welcome you. In fact, there are a number of ways to do that. You can join us by phone, of course, at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Interested in hearing from listeners of Mexican descent. Do you feel that tie to the homeland? I mean, if you emigrated from that country, do you feel that sense of, aching almost, I think is the way Fredo describes it, for the homeland, but also a question certainly that many of you may have about somebody who's been working and as a working journalist covering the drug cartel and covering Mexico for these many years. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786, and you can join us now. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website and simply posting any questions or comments you have, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum, or you can also communicate with us by going to our Facebook page. We'd certainly like to hear your thoughts. And again, ask Mexican nationals, do you ache for the roots, or questions or comments you have about present change of, well, political administrations in Mexico. You said you were sad about it. You're still sad about it. Huh?
About the return of the PRI.
About Peña Nieto and the turn of the PRI, even though it's supposed to be a new PRI, like there was a new Nixon. You remember?
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, I think I've had a long conflict or debate with my uncle. My uncle is a very, very staunch PRI member. Out of Durango, as well as many members of my family. And I always told my uncle, I said, just give the opposition a chance. You know, we'll turn Mexico around. So when after 12 years of the PAN, my uncle called me one night and said, we'll take over from now. You know, we will get back and get this country moving again. Interestingly, he has a lot of roots here in California in the San Joaquin Valley. So he passes through El Paso and we talked and he said, it's not as easy as I thought, you know. Back then, there were three cartels. Now it's been fragmented. There's something like 70 smaller cartels. Who do you talk to? I mean, how do you find that accommodation again between government and cartels?
And what do you do about the appetite for drugs north of the border to the Colossus of the North? That's what's feeding it, of course. We'll continue with our guest, Alfredo Corchado. Again, his new book is Midnight in Mexico, and you can feel free to join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or again, you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Alfredo Corchado, Mexico's bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News, who has been reporting on Mexico's drug war since 1994. And the cartels murdered journalists, and in 2007, he was told he was their next target. He's with us to talk about his new book, Midnight in Mexico, and sharing his thoughts about Mexico's future and past. And I should mention that he will be speaking tonight at Copperfield's Books and Music in Santa Rosa at 7 p.m. You can actually meet him there. You can also join us on the program. We welcome your involvement. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Or go to our Facebook page. And I'm going to go to your calls here in just a moment. I just want to get you on the record, though, Alfredo, about a couple of other things. One is the people have kind of a Hollywoodized version of how ruthless and how vicious many in these cartels can be. I was mentioning that film of Oliver Stone's, for example, which is a good example of that. But you go into some detail here about, for example, they'll get a recruit, a possible recruit in the cartels, and they'll just say, there's somebody, kill him, you know. And if they show that they don't have the machismo or whatever, I mean, most of them, I assume, are male, or they're all male recruits, they can die.
I mean, I often feel like as a journalist, I witnessed the beauty and the savagery of my homeland. And that was one of the, I think, examples that best exemplifies just the horrendous side of Mexico. And in one particular case, one of the head leaders of the Zetas, I mean, the way he would recruit people is force them to, you know, to become hitmen, or if he was having a good day, you know, and then these guys could not pull the trigger and kill someone right next to them or in front of them. If he was having a good day, he would say, okay, maybe you're just a lookout, you know, an halcón, and help us maintain the information flow in the community. Or if had no use for them, no need for them, he would just either have that person kill or force the other person to kill the guy who couldn't pull the trigger. Beheadings. I mean, it is a side of Mexico that I think, easy to say, you know, the monster came out, if you will.
Well, you talk about, again, evil, using your mother's word. That's a theological word in many ways, but there really is a kind of vicious and dark sense that you pretty much are able to chronicle in this book, where life becomes, again, like fly, swatting a fly.
Right. I mean, I think when my mom uses the word evil, she's always, you know, felt that if you live in a country without a rule of law, really the only thing you have going, the only thing you can maintain and the only way to survive is through your faith. And that's still very much in many parts of Mexico, you know, that people can at any moment take matters into their own hands and just apply the law themselves.
Are you at this point in favor of the sort of comprehensive immigration reform that may indeed find its way through the House of Representatives?
Well, you know, as a reporter, I'm not.
But you've written this book, and it's a memoir. It's all kinds of feeling, your emotions. So you can say this off the journalist record.
Sure, we're off the record here. So I would
just
say
thousands
that,
of listeners,
right,
on the record.
Right. But I mean, I would say that, look, one of the things that I've learned and covering Mexico is the separations of families. I mean, I go to communities and you see all these abandoned communities. As an immigrant myself, my father would come home once a year. I mean, as a kid, I didn't even know I had a father. I would call him Señor. But I knew that once a year he would show up in San Luis de Cordero, Durango. And to me, he was my Santa Claus, because on his way from California, he would stop in El Paso and buy us little Tony Lama boots. And, you know, there was a little gift, and we spent a month, 2-3 months. It all depended on the rains in California. If it was raining, then he would stay. If it stopped raining, then he was back here preparing the fields. I visit these communities these days, and I wonder, you know, how many of these kids, how many of these teenagers have actually met their fathers? You see the separation of families. I think that's devastating for Mexico. If there's anything I think that Mexicans would want to see is a return of circularity, of people can go back and forth and have that choice whether to stay in the United States and make a future or go back home and try to repopulate, try to bring back those communities and make them vibrant again.
Let's bring our callers into this, and we begin, Guillermo, with you. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Nice show. Hey, you mentioned early above the nostalgia for your own homeland. And you mentioned that it's only happened to a certain group. I think it's something in general for any person who comes to the United States, whether it's from Europe or from El Salvador or from any other country in the whole entire planet, who migrates to this country and you live for a little while here and you start to compare your homeland and this, but and so one point in your life when you start to think like an American. And when you go back home, you see that differences because you're not anymore longer, you belong to that, you were born in that place, but you start to see yourself, oh, I'm an American, or you have absorbed so much the American culture in certain ways.
I think isn't that what they call assimilation, Guillermo?
Yeah, well, but, you know, it's interesting because I'm in one point of my life that I feel more American than Salvadorian. Even though I feel sorry for all the things that happen in my home country, which is not only, the cartels are not only in Mexico, they're all over in Central America as well. And the same damage they're making in Mexico is the same damage that is happening in Central America as well. So bottom line is it's something that you really feel very deep inside, but then you look at it from the eyes. The way that I see things now in Latin America is through my American Hispanic American eyes and understanding the politics and all the conflicts there happening up there. I look at them back and I say, you know, why wouldn't do something like that? And I start to write to my representatives now here in the United States. I want you to put pressure on this issue because.
Well, Guillermo, pardon me. How long have you been in the United States?
25 years.
Okay. Well, that's, and Fredo, I think it does sometimes boil down to longevity of time here, doesn't it?
Longevity. You know, one of the things that was interesting about writing this book, that's a great question, Guillermo, because one of the things I found, and I formed this little club, if you will, people who were reading the book, and some of them were not Mexican. Some of them were not even Americans. There was one from India who, after read the final manuscript, said, you know what, this is not a book about Mexico. It's not a book about the United States. It's a book about us. And that was the biggest...
Or about homeland.
Right. It's about homeland, and whether it's India, whether it's El Salvador, whether it's Mexico.
I know Mexican-Americans who have been here as long as Guillermo, and Salvadorians who have been here as long as Guillermo, and Guatemalans and so forth. And, yeah, they may see things through American eyes. They may be totally assimilated and so forth, but still the flags, the teams, the soccer team. I mean, you know, all of those things, the food... The identity is still extraordinarily strong.
The music.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
every cultural thing.
One of the things that I did with this book is I
and
wrote
the
it.
And language in many cases.
Right. I wrote it on both sides of the border. And it was interesting. You're writing it on both sides, but I kept listening to some of the same songs, you know, the Mexican songs. And it just brings it out in you. But throughout this book, it's a journey. And one of the questions I keep asking is, what am I, American? Am I Mexican? And I think throughout the journey, I came to one conclusion. I don't really have to choose anymore.
Well, they have this new semantic thing called hybrid identity.
Right.
Hybridized American identity. And that's good enough. let me get another caller from Texas. Alex, hi.
Hi there. I actually used to be an editor for an online publication doing global drug news. And I actually stopped doing that, to be honest, because I was a little bit nervous myself about attracting any cartel attention, and I've decided to kind of redirect my efforts towards the doing something about the cartels in my own way with education for people north of the border, you know, what the human cost is of their use of cocaine and other things that are brought in by the cartels from Central and South America. But I actually am Mexican-American. My great-grandfather was a politician during the Revolution and fled to the U.S., with his family, so I have a lot of strong ties to Mexico in a lot of ways, and I've returned to school to become an anthropology student, and I've become increasingly aware of how many of these issues are due to colonialism. Your guest said something a little while ago about this being one of the darkest times in Mexico's history, but this has actually been going on for 500 years. I mean, the cartels, if nothing else, have bought into the European conquistadors' idea of the accumulation of resources and wealth at any cost, including that of eradicating anybody who stands in their way or any human life. And that's not ever being looked at too closely.
Where is the caller based out of? Where in Texas are you? are you based out of?
I'm in Austin.
I mean, one of the things that was interesting was covering a court case out of Austin recently and seeing how these cartels, I mean, you see names, you see faces. I mean, they're right there in the United States. It's always shocks me when people say, oh, my God, they're here. Of course they're here. I mean, it's a billion dollar industry. And you're right. I mean, this has been going on for many, many decades, you know, generations. What I find interesting and hopeful about Mexico is during this dark time, during some of the worst moments in Mexico, you also see some of the best of Mexicans. I mean, you see them, this resilient spirit that comes out, the courage. I mean, oftentimes I have the choice of, you know, going back to El Paso or Dallas, but it's really the sense of courage and the sense of determination that Mexicans have to try to rebuild their country, to try to really have laws at work that inspire you to try to tell their stories.
So difficult, though, with the corruption. I mean, you know, it's daunting and sometimes just too formidable. I mean, you know, we've done enough shows, you too. Corruption is pervasive in Mexican culture.
Corruption is like an institution in Mexico.
Yeah.
I've been in Mexico for 20 years. And I have seen society slowly change. I mean, I think one of the best times of the day for me is in the morning when you're listening to the radio and you're reading the newspapers and you see the changes, you know. Yes, there are some regions in Mexico where journalism is very, very – there have been big blows to journalism. But also there are signs where there's a new generation of people really trying to hold government accountable. One of the journalists who won the Pulitzer this year, a Mexican journalist – worked with the New York Times and helped uncover the whole Walmart corruption case by testing Mexico's new transparency laws. Daunting, indeed, but you see a society that's marching on, you know, slowly. The changes that, you know, I talk about, that we all maybe talk about, may not happen in a lifetime, but there is a path.
Your hope is still, it's refreshing to hear. And Alex, thank you. Good to hear from you. In fact, She just decided to close shop, and it reminded me of somebody you write about in your book who was running a newspaper and writing about the cartels, and then suddenly one of the cartels did some assassinating, and they wound up working for the cartels.
You're talking about the El Mañana newspaper?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, he didn't end up working for the cartels. He ended up agreeing with the cartels not to publish stories about them, which I guess in a sense, he was forced to censor. And he did end up leaving Nuevo Laredo along with many members of his family, now lives in Laredo, still runs a paper, you know, with the help of the internet, and does travel back and forth. But he was one of those cases that's not very unique in Mexico. I have a lot of journalists who either flee for the U.S., seek political asylum in the U.S., or just, you know, you put your head down and try not to make noise. Bloggers have also been victims of this. I mean, it's, you know, oftentimes it really depends on the region, and the Austin region, I think, is one where the sectas are heavy, in deep in that area. I mean, there are some risks for people even on the U.S. side of the border.
I've been saying Zetas, you know, I'm thinking Greek, but a Setas, of
Setas.
Course, would be, yeah. Spencer writes, I've always assumed the cartels were businessmen, not ideologues. If that's so, does the Mexican drug war hold lessons for the United States about the dangers of unregulated capitalism and corporate power?
That's a great question. I mean, the cartels are actually marketing geniuses. I mean, they know all about markets. And when you think about it, it's really a small group of farmers out of Sinaloa, you know, many, many decades ago, who started this whole thing. And they always find a way to adapt to the consumer demands in the United States. I think many of them, you know, would like to go back to the old ways, because all this violence has really disrupted their business.
Here's a tweet from a listener named Brian who says, we have outsourced our drug war killings to Mexico.
Yes. You know, it's easy when you have a country with a very low conviction rate, bad rule of law. But in the end, you know, it's really about contraband and organized crime. I mean, it's drugs today, marijuana, cocaine. I always imagine, you know, if President Obama legalized drugs tomorrow, I can imagine Michelle Obama saying, you know, let's ban those Mexican cookies. They're making Americans fat. And I can imagine Chapo Guzman calling his lieutenants.
They're going to be LSB Toklas cookies, or
yeah,
something.
And say we're shipping them to the U.S. They've been banned, so there's a demand now.
Let me go to a caller who's calling us from Mexico. Kelly, where are you in Mexico?
Ajijic, just south of Guadalajara.
Yeah. Hi. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I wanted to ask Alfredo about the mission of meth labs in Guadalajara. Guadalajara is now becoming one of the meth capitals of North America. And that's because...
I'm sorry, Kelly, we've got a lousy phone line here, but I hope you can listen. She wants to know about meth labs in Guadalajara. There is a proliferation.
Oh, yeah, big explosion. And that's also tied into the violence that we've seen there. I mean, when I talked about cartels becoming smaller, fragmentized, the Jalisco region, that whole area is a big example, and meth is a big cause of that.
She wanted to know about impact, though, on drug policies. Anything discernible on that score?
On the U.S. side?
Yeah.
It's a big demand in the United States. I mean, there's not much... That might change.
Faye writes on our website, any comment from Alfredo about Mexico's military incursions into the U.S.? Both vehicles and even helicopters have been reported in Texas. I'm surprised that this isn't an international incident. If Mexico had asset forfeiture laws for criminals like the U.S. does, the money collected could help alleviate Mexico's poverty. Are prosecutors scared, or how high in the government does the narco dollar corruption reach? I think we've answered that question.
Yeah, I mean, we reported on that, on these questions. I mean, it does happen from time to time. It's, you know, oftentimes along the border, it's really hard to know where Mexico begins and where Mexico ends.
Enrique writes, taking the IRS out of this discussion is ridiculous. The second priority of government after security is revenue. Cell phone traffic is the ideal means to detect drug traffickers. Why won't this be part of the use of the data? If the database is there, it'll be used by anyone with access. If you don't want it used, it can't be collected.
One of the interesting things that came out of this court case in Austin was how the U.S. agents were tracking down, in this case, the CETAs, by they had their pins to their BlackBerry phones. And so I think from time to time, they knew exactly what was happening. The CETAs will retaliate by burning down houses of snitches and so forth. So it has happened.
Talking again with Alfredo Corchado, and you can feel free to join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Gabriel is the next caller. Gabriel, you're on.
Yes, Michael. Thank you for taking my call. I'm very, very surprised and appalled by this. Mr. Corchado's comments. I mean, how can you praise and say that the cartels or the drug smuggler dealers are genius? Are they just plain old criminals? I know Dallas, and Dallas is so full of them. You know, I think the problem here is that the new generation or the new wave of Mexicans do not hold allegiance to the United States. I immigrated 50 years ago with my family 50 years ago in August. This will be our family 50th anniversary. And we came to the United States, and we hold, and I love this country, and I have no allegiance to Mexico. I have my allegiance to this country. They gave me, saw me grow up, and gave me an education, and prepared me to face the workforce. But to say that they're genius and to praise them, and you know, the new waves of Mexicans are all the way from the...
Well, forgive me, Gabriel, you can call somebody a genius and agree that they're an evil genius. People have said Hitler was a genius, for example.
Oh, you know, but that doesn't mean, you know, these cartels are killing young people with all their poison, you know? And this for someone to say, you know, over the radio that these people are, you know, entrepreneurs, they're not. They're criminals, bottom line. You know, and also, how can if we don't assimilate, if we don't become American, true blooded or true allegiance to this country, we will never have a political voice power. This is why we are not, you know, active in the political arena. You know,
Let me get a response from Alfredo Curchado. Gabriel, thank you for the call.
Well, thank you, Michael, because I mean that's exactly what I meant. I mean they are murderers. They've killed people without any remorse and
I don't think you were flattering them.
Right, cold-blooded killers. I mean, but they do have a way of knowing, of anticipating what the United States demand is and meeting that demand. I would say, I mean, I call myself a son of Mexico, but it's really this country that's also giving me everything that I have and that I am today.
But you hit a nerve with him, with that caller, because he wants full allegiance. If you're going to be an American citizen, you ought to have
full allegiance. But he makes a good point, because one of the things that's interesting about the U.S. government and the American government, I mean the Mexican government today, is they're both in the process of trying to build a bridge between Americans of Mexican descent, 30, 35 million, not trace their roots back to Mexico, and the same thing with the Mexican government. I mean, they're looking at models like the Irish model and the Jewish model to try to kind of soften policy for both sides of the border. So I think that's one of the stories that will continue to play out in the years to come, especially after the elections last November, when Hispanics finally found their stride in the booth.
Listener named Peter writes, can your guest comment on what, if anything, Carlos Slim, that's the Mexican business magnate and investor and philanthropist, is doing to improve Mexican justice?
That's a great question. I mean, he's one of the reforms that was passed, the telecom, will actually, you know, will have a big impact on him and on his big dynasty. But I often find myself when I live in Mexico, shop in Mexico, read in Mexico, and I often find that much of my money that day is spent with Carlos Slim's, or is given to Carlos Slim's pocketbook. Yeah.
Another listener writes, yes, the cartels are everywhere. This is Steve. But here's an interesting comparison. I lived in Oakland for 20 years, and now I've lived in Oaxaca for 6 years. I feel safer on a day-to-day basis in Oaxaca. We are off the main transshipment routes, but the narco-trafficantes are here. In Oakland, I watched kids who grew up mowing my lawn turn into gang members. Their choices were limited. Great kids, but that was the world they were in.
There are many, many places in Mexico that are very safe. And I don't mean to suggest...
Especially the heavy tourist areas.
Right, when, you know. Right. But I don't mean to suggest that all of Mexico is a bunch of drug traffickers. I mean, there are many, many... good people, good-hearted people, people who live with dignity and integrity, and a lot of very safe communities throughout the country. It's, you know, usually regions where there are distribution routes that lead to the United States that are more questionable.
And Claudia writes, I'm an immigrant from Michoacan, Mexico. My family's homes were heavily shot at on April 28th. Please ask Alfredo what someone in the U.S. can do to help families back home who are victims of the ongoing violence.
What I was trying to explain earlier is that, you know, there is, I think with the change of government, there is a sense that there has to be more pressure or continued pressure from the U.S. side, you know, whether it's the local congressman, but there has to be a way where the government understands that you can't just turn the page. And I go back to this, you know, the Irish immigrant experience and the Jewish experience, where I think Mexicans would like to see a bridge between both countries. It's one of the things that's interesting about Mexico is it's the whole issue of sovereignty isn't as important as it used to be. I mean, we've done polls at the Dallas Morning News, and you see those numbers. I mean, it's still a big issue, I think, with politicians when they try to beat up the bully in order to try to score points. But average Mexicans, you know, in part because of the changing demographics in the United States and their ties between the United States and Mexico, you see less of that sovereignty. And so there's more of an, I think, more of a hope that we can create ties between both sides of the border.
This brings me right to a question. Looking back again, take off your journalistic hat if you can. NAFTA, has it been good for Mexico or bad, mostly? Which part of the ledger would you look?
I would generally say it's been good. I mean, it's a trade. It's about trade. But I think if you look back, it's really made Mexico a much more open society.
And the maquiladoras notwithstanding.
Maquiladoras, a lot of them employed my relatives on the Juarez side. And, you know, one of the things that happened in Juarez is that when the violence hit, it was also as a reaction to the economic disaster in the U.S., and so you don't have jobs. You have people who will look for jobs in other means. You know, some of them became hitmen or halcones, et cetera.
Anna asks, I'm always torn between trying to promote an immigration law or trying to promote a law on assault weapons. I'm interested to know what you consider more important or of a higher priority as far as safety in Mexico is concerned.
Well, as I said earlier, I mean, I think immigration is still an important thing. We're, you know, try to go back to the circularity, people going back and forth. But something like 60% or 70% of weapons that are used in Mexico to kill people come from the United States. It's a tough call. I mean, I'm not sure.
Maybe
what
an impossible call in some ways. Huh? And a tweet from Christina says, I'm curious regarding Mr. Corchado's sense of internet usage in Mexico. How wired is Mexico? Are computers as available to K-12 students in Mexico?
I think the last number I saw was something like 30%, a third of the population. But it is it's an important tool. I live just a few blocks from this so-called Lady Profeco incident, where a woman comes in and tries to get a her favorite table, and she can't. And she, you know, starts this big argument, and then some of the customers actually took out their phones, started tweeting the exchange. Next thing you know, the consumer protection guy is fired, and his daughter ends up apologizing for you know, having the gall to say, that's my chair, or you'll pay the price.
And we've spent this hour with Alfredo Corchado. He will be at Copperfield Books tonight. That's Copperfield's in Santa Rosa at 7 p.m. His book, again, is called Midnight in Mexico. And good to have you with us. And I want to meet Guerita. She's here with you. Huh?
Guerita's here, also an accomplished journalist.
Who has a prominent role in this book.
Yeah. Accomplished journalist from the first pages of this book to the last pages. Born in Mexico City, and actually the one that helped me find my way back to Mexico.
Well, congratulations on the book. Buena suerte. Good luck with it. And so good to have you here in the studio. We will continue to check in with you, of course, as we have been wont to do. Alfredo Corchado, we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening, and remind you that you can continue this discussion or go to our website and continue to put remarks on or, well, communicate back and forth about the things that we've raised in this hour. KQED.org/forum and simply click on this segment. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.